It's pretty amazing when you think about what we did. We filmed American wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
All of it. Frogs, snakes, mice, birds. Yeah, there were eagles and there were moose and there were grizzly bears and there was all this stuff. But there were bunny rabbits and squirrels and every kind of little bird and hummingbirds and salamanders and stuff. Let's face it. I mean, Wild Kingdom and Jacques Cousteau and Walt Disney, none of them were putting salamanders on television.
Right.
None of them were putting grasshopper mice, the so-called killer mice, on television. They just weren't. Hello, I'm Marty Stauffer, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. Today, we have a real legend in the world of film documentaries. If you are my age, you may remember Marty Stauffer from Wild America. Marty Stauffer's Wild America. It was an incredible program. He did documentaries on all types of wildlife, and he was doing it on American wildlife. And it was interesting because at the time you had Jacques Cousteau going to the deepest parts of the ocean. You had Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom going to these crazy faraway destinations to film exotic species and stuff people had never seen before. And those were obviously very, very popular shows. Meanwhile, Marty Stauffer decided he was going to film American wildlife, moose, bison, elk, grizzly bears. But he also didn't just concentrate on big game animals. He did everything, salamanders, little mice, anything that was interesting. And he managed to make some really, really incredible television shows called Marty Stauffer's Wild America. Someone asked me on the text thread, you can also do this if you would like to. You can text me at 305-930-7346. And you could give me show suggestions. This is exactly where this one came from. Somebody said, I think you ought to track down Marty Stauffer and see if you could get him on the show. And sure enough, that's exactly what I did. I was like, Marty Stauffer, there's a name I haven't thought of in a long time. I loved that show growing up. And sure enough, contacted him. He was happy to do it. And he can tell some stories. He can tell a lot of stories, and that's what we're about to do. We're about to listen to a lot of stories from Marty Stauffer. So I want to thank you for the suggestion and stand by for a podcast which goes over all kinds of stuff about how early film documentaries were made, including linear editing, which, oh my gosh, what an incredibly laborious process this was compared to, you guys don't know how easy you got it. Just editing something on your iPhone. It's so easy. It's so easy. And the quality's so high. He was carrying hundreds of pounds worth of equipment up there. And then that was just the beginning of what it takes to make a documentary from film. It's really a different world, a completely different world. So if you're interested in film documentaries, you're interested in Marty Stauffer, stand by, get ready. Here we go. All right, Marty Stauffer, man, thank you for being on the podcast. This is I got to say, man, it's an honor, and I'm a fan. I watched your stuff growing up, and it probably had a lot to do with me becoming a television producer of my own. But man, it's awesome to have you here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I could say something cute like, well, I guess that shows that there's not a great barrier to entry.
Well,
and Tom, the funny thing is what I say really about the beginning in my entire career, but the beginning of the Wild America series. And when we first, got it on television, well, we began before that. Actually, we did a couple of John Denver specials with my brother, Mark Stauffer. Oh, I did really the way that I got into the business was doing films. that were sold educationally to schools and libraries. But I'll come back to that, because what I was just getting ready to say was, and this is really a shout out to all the young people out there, or, you know, people who, you know, wannabes who'd like to make something, you know, make some kind of video, film these days, of course, is pretty much all video, is that the only reason I was as successful as I am is because I didn't know that I was not supposed to be able to do what it was that I was going to do. If you look back, here's some young kid from Arkansas. I was a little more than a kid at the time, but we'd made Super 8 movies, 8mm movies, and Super 8 movies, goofy little things, you know, just to show to our friends. And we really just learned by doing. And like I said, as the time went on, you know, you need to decide whether you're going to be a butcher, baker, candlestick maker, whatever. Well, I decided that I wanted to be an attorney. Now, the reason I wanted to be an attorney, a friend of mine, Pete Daly, his father, Jack Daly, was an attorney in Fort Smith, Arkansas, where we grew up. They lived maybe a couple of blocks away, and my father had a shop right on the corner, four-way stop sign. So you saw pretty much everybody coming and going. And Mr. Daly would go by on a regular basis in his station wagon. If he didn't have fishing poles and a canoe on top, he had his bird dogs in the back. Mm-hmm. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, because certainly the man was an attorney and he had a job. But he always found time to get out in the woods, and we'd go hunting. We'd bird hunt at certain times of the year, or we'd go fishing ourselves. But it just seemed like Mr. Daly was always on his way to doing something exciting. And so I said, well, if that's what attorneys do, then by golly, I want to be an attorney for whatever. And with that in mind, I went to the University of Arkansas. And so I majored in English. And the reason that I majored in English, which was really a great major, because I've been able to write and express myself well, you know, in subsequent years. But, and I took Latin, actually, thinking that a couple of years of Latin, you know, would be homo amasamat, I don't know, you know, lawyers, you know, the law, the legal, whatever, you need Latin, which I took instead of Spanish, which probably these days Spanish would be a lot more, let's say, usable.
Yeah.
If you took a vacation down in Mexico, you know, than Latin, because, well, you don't use Latin.
Right.
You know, pretty much regardless of who you are or where you are or who you're talking to, except that. And I've traveled a little bit in Europe, and I do find that with that Latin background, there are some languages, Italian, French to a lesser degree, and I actually took French in high school. But the point is that you can kind of figure out, and even Spanish, you can figure out some words that are relative, you know, that mm-hmm. relate to Latin, you know, kind of a base language.
Yeah.
But, steer me however you want. I mean, I can throw me a subject.
I like where you're going. I wanted to, you know, I did as much research as I could before the podcast. Honestly, I didn't come up with as much as I thought I would. But it did seem like one interesting thing that I did come up with, and because I'm a television producer and have been on a lot of different networks myself, I found it really an interesting piece of information that I saw was that your show Wild America was the most viewed show on PBS. According to Wikipedia. So I'm asking you if that's the case.
That's quite correct. And there's a reason for that. And it was, I'll blame myself, credit myself, with that. The way, and sorry if I'm talking down to people, but probably a lot of people understand, realize that when you produce a television program, you license it to somebody. Mm-hmm. And when you license it, that means you're going to give them the right to show it, and they're going to give you money in exchange. And hopefully they'll give you enough money to pay for making it and to also pay for going to do another one. Mm-hmm. That being the crux of the matter. Well, in the case of PBS, which is where Wild America, the series, ended up first, I'll even come back to the networks, but first I'll tell PBS because that's a big success story. PBS when you licensed a series to PBS way back then, it was 1981. And you'll see that I interrupt myself sometimes just to throw in a bit of additional information. That was the second year I went to a PBS convention. The first year I didn't sell it. I'll come back to that. I'll finish the part about the rights first, and then I'll come back to the story of Wild America and how it happened. But as far as the rights were concerned, the producers for PBS would license it, and their standard was 4 runs over 3 years. And so let's say, for example, we did the Wild America series. We did 10 half hours a year on PBS for 11 years, 11 seasons. I did one more a year after that, year 12, was out of my own time pocket, whatever. But the point is that the PBS license was 4 runs over 3 years, and that's what most of the other, I think it's fair to say all of the other producers did. It was just, you know, whatever, that was just par for the course. Well, my logic was, well, wait a second. You know, that means that, you know, there's 364 days a year when nobody's going to be showing that particular program mm-hmm. about a moose or a duck or a possum or whatever it is, which seemed like a waste to me for 2 reasons. One is, and, you know, going, I'd bounce around some, way back in Sunday school, one of the things that we taught, you know, one of the things we learned was, don't hide your candle. Don't hide your light under a basket. Hmm. You know, I just remember that as a kid. Don't hide your light under the basket. Let it show. You know, let it out. Let it show. And I was going, well, okay. To me, that means that I don't want to hoard. I don't want to restrict. I don't want to say, no. You only get to show it one time. I can understand the pure and simple logic for that. The pure and simple logic for that is, you don't want to overdo it. You don't want to show it too many times. You don't want the audience to go, oh my gosh, there's that program I've seen again. You know, oh, I already saw that one. You know, show me something new. And I understand that perfectly. But with that in mind, a year was a long time to wait mm-hmm. to show that particular program again. As an aside, what I will say is the Wild America series was and is 10 half-hour episodes each year. Mm-hmm. So in year 1 for PBS, we did 10. Year 2, we did 10 more. So then they're showing 20. Year 3, we did 10 more. So then they're showing 30. Year 4, we did 10 more, you know, et cetera, 10, 10, 10, 10. So at the very end, it was 110 episodes, 10 new and 100 reruns of previous years. So the point of the matter is that as a producer, egotistically, proudly, light not under the basket. I said, no, that's crazy. You know, no, 4 runs in 3 years. No, heck no. Show the socks off of them. Show the pants off of them. Show them any darn time you want. Show them morning, noon, and night for all I care based on your programmer's needs. Mm-hmm. And boy, oh boy, did they.
Yeah.
And that's really the long and the short of it is that there were times, and this was really probably in the mid 80s, there were times, and maybe more other times, but when we have those numbers, 450 million views of a Wild America episode in a week.
Wow.
450 million.
That's incredible. I mean,
it's impossible.
We don't have that now.
Like, no good. Well, if probably the highest rated program on television, I'm going to make a wild guess. What, 100 million viewers?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, pick your favorite program, pick your most popular program. I'd have to make a guess. Out of 320 million people in America, there's probably 100 million would be a gigantic, whatever that Nielsen rating would be, mm-hmm. Viewership
yeah.
of that program. But keep in mind, when we did The Predators, which was April of 1977, that was this was before PBS and Wild America. We did The Predators in April of 1977. Robert Redford narrated it. It was on prime time on NBC, and we had a 26 share wow. of that, give or take 100 million people at that time. It's probably more than that now, but that's why that number, you know, pops into my head of the viewership in America. So give or take, we had a 26 share of everybody watching television for that hour for the wild, I'm sorry, not wild, I misspoke, for the Predators, 1 hour special on NBC, narrated by Robert Redford. It's probably 7 p.m. on a Thursday night, as I recall. The point of that being that the multiple broadcasts and usage of Wild America by the PBS stations, and I think I'm correct in saying at that time there were about 260, maybe 265 PBS stations. I could go into how that gets licensed, and which is an interesting story. It was back then. So those stations then would literally have the Wild America episodes. And as I said, growing 10, 20, 40, mm-hmm. 60, more and more, you know, at their disposal. And they would show them at 9 or 10 a.m.
Right.
They would show them at noon, lunchtime, 12 or 1. They'd show them in the afternoon when the kids got out of school, 3 or 4. They'd show them in the evening. Now, keeping in mind, the evenings, they really, you know, the prime time was a little more restricted. So I think Wild America pretty much aired on Thursdays at a certain time. Then for a while, it aired on Saturdays and Sundays at a certain time. But they weren't showing it, you know, like, they weren't stripping it, which mm-hmm. is called Monday through Friday, you know,
right.
7 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Some stations did, but in general, the prime time was more, you know, the top quality, the brand new PBS stuff. But as I said, what they did then, morning, noon, and evening before prime time and late at night, they played them like it was one of their most popular series and people wanted to see it, which it was, and they did.
Yeah.
And so the ratings, the feedback, all of that, you know, for the individual stations was terrific. And you know, Tom, it's funny. I've got a lot of cute little isms, whatever. and one of my isms is, and this goes back to, you know, the country boy from Arkansas who didn't know that, well, he didn't know what he didn't know. But he didn't know that he could ever do such a thing until he just, by golly, did it. And what I say is, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think about what we did. We filmed American wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
All of it. Frogs, snakes, mice, birds. Yeah, there were eagles and there were moose and there were grizzly bears and there was all this stuff. But there were bunny rabbits and squirrels and every kind of little bird and hummingbirds and salamanders and stuff. Let's face it. I mean, Wild Kingdom and Jacques Cousteau and Walt Disney, none of them were putting salamanders on television.
Right.
None of them were putting grasshopper mice, the so-called killer mice, on television. They just weren't.
Right. It was a whole new thing. I mean, and that's what I found was interesting about yours. I mean, for some reason, I remember mountain lions, grizzly bears, and like mountain lions in the snow. I remember that as something that really stuck with me. Just even as a kid, just like, how in the world did he film that? Like that just seems.
And those are the powerful predators or the bighorn rams.
Right.
That's kind of like,
yeah, the rams. Exactly.
Or whatever. Boom. The bighorn butting heads or moose fighting or,
yeah,
you know, a bear roaring. Oh, don't get me wrong. They're dramatic and they're incredible and they're powerful, sure, and they're amazing. But the point is, all these other little critters were all equally fascinating,
right,
when we got into filming them. So anyway, you can see I interrupt myself and I'll go off, but then I'll come back where I started. And where I started with that was it basically, wait a second. American wildlife, people love animals, wildlife, outdoors, you know, people fish, people hunt, people bird watch. People love looking at a deer with a baby fawn in their backyard. You know, it's very exciting. It's primal love instinct. American wildlife for an American audience on television. Why the heck didn't somebody think of that before me? Wild Kingdom is traveling all over the world. Jacques Cousteau is traveling all over the ocean. Walt Disney, in fairness, they did a couple of fabulous films, Vanishing Prairie. Was one of their feature films, which was terrific. Living Desert was one of their feature films, which was terrific. But in general, then when the new programming came around, and not to give them a hard time, but, you know, Disney was busy doing Lefty the Ding-a-Ling Lynx and Ida the Offbeat Eagle, And they were doing programs that were, let's just say, more popularized, more humanized. The word is anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the animals with little human voices and little human stories. And, right. you know, they got their wife and their kids. And I'm exaggerating a little bit. And don't get me wrong, Walt Disney.
That's coming back.
Man.
That's coming back. There's a popular one right now on Netflix. I can't stand it. It's like that. It's like these human voices on these animals and they try to make jokes and it's terrible. I don't like it at all.
Keep in mind, let me criticize myself while I'm criticizing others. We did, after the 120 half hours in the Wild America series, we did in conjunction with King World, who was at the time producing Oprah and Inside Edition. King World was very successful in licensing 1 hour versions of the Wild America specials. Hmm. So there's 120 half hours in the Wild America series, and there's also a dozen, 12 1 hour specials. Those specials were produced. Some of them we produced before. The Man Who Loved Bears, which was narrated by both Will Gear and Henry Fonda, and also The Predators, narrated by Robert Redford. Those ended up with the so-called Wild America 12 one-hour specials. But also what we did was we produced some others. We produced Dangerous Encounters, Grr, and Everything Attacks. We produced... Tender Times, Cute Babies, etc. And we produced one. Wild Wings was about birds, but we produced one, which was called Wacky Babies. Mm-hmm. And we did use a comedy troupe, voices, male and female, you know, men and women, guys and girls, voices. And it was wacky. It was, you know, like I said, Wacky Babies. Oh, look out. You know, oh, it's kind of, you know, he got me. Oh, ha, ha, ha. You know, it's kids love it.
Yeah.
But it was far from, let's just call it biology. It was far from, let's say, scientific. It was definitely done in an anthropomorphic manner for that purpose.
Right.
To amuse. Humor, silly, goofy. We didn't do that very much, but mea culpa, you know, we did that one. So I'm just kind of rambling here, but yeah. The point was, go ahead.
Well, I want to ask you, you mentioned that you really bucked the trend of producers giving someone the right to run something, as many times as they wanted to. And obviously it was successful for PBS and they obviously were selling a lot of commercials and a lot of people were watching. Now, you know, looking back on that, was that a good decision financially? Was that a good, did that, if you were to, you know, nobody has a crystal ball and you said like, you don't know what you didn't know. And so you just thought you wanted to shine your light everywhere. When you look back on that, was that a good decision or, did that play a part in the future things that you did or what?
Well, let me ramble. certainly it was a great thing because PBS had a vast audience.
Right.
And when you have a lot of people following a series and calling up and, you know, the way PBS works, you know, they would have, you know, their fundraiser drives. So people calling up and saying, hey, I like that Wild America thing. Here's my $10. Here's my donation. Here's my membership. Keep them coming. There's no question whatsoever that the popularity of Wild America is the reason that it was on PBS for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so what how that worked was that there were 11 years in the series, which were done for PBS, that were on PBS. And then they extended the rights several more years, I think 3 or 4 more years. And to show them, but also because when they bought year 11, they got 3 years, you know, usage rights from it. And I'm not shy about saying this, you know, films are very expensive to make.
Yeah.
You know, these numbers will kind of boggle your mind, but still relative to big time network television, you know, 1 million an hour or whatever. Right. We were peanuts. I mean, the first year of Wild America was programs that I'd already produced. Sorry, Tom, I'm just...
No, we're all good, man. Keep going.
It all ties together. Let me back up a little bit. I got out of college, University of Arkansas, the degree in English in 1970, and started making wildlife films. I had an allowance from my father. I did some part-time jobs. I'm a welder. I'm a hot rod builder. I'm a lot of different things. Worked in Fort Smith Plywood Factory, a $49 a week take-home pay. But the point of the matter, back as a welder, Heliarc welder, $49 a week take-home pay. But I had a $350 a month allowance from my father. Many years later, I paid him back. I think it was $190,000. many years later, and that funded my parents' retirement. But the point of the matter is that I was scraping by. And what we did was we made films, my brother Mark and I, some other friends working with us, C.C. Lockwood. He's now a successful photographer down in Louisiana. David Huey was a cameraman with me. Ginger Catherines. She was my only female cameraman ever. And because, well, there's one other that worked a little bit, but basically there just weren't female cameramen. And if I found one, I hired her, and we did. And she did a fabulous job. She did the Mustang films. She was a great horse lover. But the point of the matter is that what we were doing back then, what I always did, the terminology is weird. We never filmed in video. Okay.
Film.
We never shot in video. We filmed in film.
Right.
Real film, 16 millimeter. Boy, oh boy, much more difficult. The equipment is much heavier. The process is much more complex. You can't look at what you get right there at the time. You film it and you send it into a lab and you wait to get it back to see if it's good or not. And in the case of some, it was maddening. Mm-hmm. You would set up a camera and it would be on a rail and it would be called an intervalometer, and it would take a frame, click, move a little bit, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever, click, click. So there are 24 film frames in 1 second, mm-hmm. 40 film frames in a foot, you know, foot long piece of film, literally hold it up. And depending on how many clicks you did on your intervalometer, the clouds would go, if you clicked one frame a minute, they'd be speeded up 24 times. So the clouds would be very beautiful. You know, it's 24 times. If you clicked, If you clicked like one frame a second, mm-hmm. the clouds would be beautiful. If you click one frame a minute, boom, you know, the clouds
right.
are gone.
Right.
Normally it was one frame every 5, 10, 15, 30 seconds to get a certain speed of the clouds. And of course, clouds move different speeds. And different clouds move different speeds, et cetera, et cetera. The point of the matter is that you would shoot that with a camera and you would shoot any number of those. And one individual who worked with me for many years, Greg Hensley, Greg was primarily our time-lapse guy. He would go film the mud cracking. He would go film the flowers opening. He would go film the sunrises and sunsets. I'd go, Greg, we're doing this otter film up in New York. So go shoot 5 or 10 sunrises, 5 or 10 sunsets. Try to put some rivers and lakes in the scenes, and see you in a month.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Greg's, another individual, Greg Hayes, is still a very, very successful veterinarian. The Arapaho Animal Clinic in Boulder. He has two locations. I'll give him a pitch. Here's my sponsor pitch for my great, great lifelong friend, Greg Hayes. Arapaho Animal Hospital in Boulder. He would help me out if there was ever an animal was injured or wounded, or, you know, which we did. I mean, I'll admit, you know, we would, if we found something with a broken wing, we would film it and mm-hmm. then fix its wing
right.
and then turn it loose. one thing that we filmed one time, I know I'm bouncing around. Hopefully this is still interesting and I'll get back to what I was starting to say. Was a poor will. Now, it's kind of like a whippoorwill, but it's a poor will. It's just bird. You can see them flying around in the sunset, long wings, whatever. The crazy thing is these birds hibernate, hibernate like some mammals do. And so some people near where I lived in the town of Aspen, Colorado, found this bird full torpor, you know, just like it was dead. It was asleep. It just didn't move in the winter. And brought it into a wildlife facility that is in the Aspen area. And then they called me and they said, Marty, this is kind of crazy. We got a poor will here and it's hibernating. It's plumb asleep. So we're going to keep it cold. We're not going to bring it in and warm it up and wake it up in the middle of winter. But maybe you want to film it. Okay, fine. So retrieved this sleeping, hibernating poor will, took it back to the location where it had been, put it in this little crack in a rock and filmed it. And that's our poor will sequence. And, you know, as often as not, that's, you know, I mean, that's a way that we would film some sequences is come up with an idea and then try to, you know, create that. And if you've got a poor will in a rock, fine, put it back in the rock and show it, you know, sitting there.
So sitting there. When you did that deal, that's going to be like a time-lapse thing over the rest of the winter, watching what this bird will do, or what are you doing?
We just, as I recall, I think I handled the bird and I showed, actually maybe a little rude, but I kind of opened its mouth. They've got this big mouth because they fly around and catch insects on the wing. And we didn't show it going to sleep. We didn't show it waking up. We just showed it hibernating in this location. That particular, I'm sorry, because I was talking about time lapse and then I jumped off on the poor will because the point of that, well, I'm just bouncing around. The point of that is it popped into my mind. But so we would shoot intervalometer scenes and even more, let's just say, not painful necessarily, but more involved. We would shoot slow motion scenes. And so the film would go through the camera 24 frames a second. The sound I make is, you know, one 24th of a second, you know, for each one, 24 frames a second. When you speed that up, so the bird is flying, you speed it up to 48 frames a second. You speed it up to 100 frames a second. Mm-hmm. You speed it up to 300 frames a second, you know, to slow down the bird. So in other words, film's going through. Oh man, how much did that cost?
Right.
Well, a lot, because we just shot 300 frames a second, which is 12 times faster, so that a 10-minute roll of film doesn't even last 1 minute. And the point I'm making on all this, the intervalometer, the slow motion, is that when we shot film, and I rarely do anymore, but I'd love to have a project, but, you know, just doesn't really happen. You would then put it in a black bag. You put the camera magazine into a black bag. You stick your arms in. You take it out. You put it in a film can. You tape it up. You ship it off to a film lab. The film lab puts it through a big machine and develops the film, the whole film. Then they make a print of the whole film, and that's your work print. So you got your original and your work print, and you take the work print and you chop it all up. On it, you have a machine with a screen on it. There's several different kinds of machines. One is a movie scope. It's a small one. Back then, we had Moviolas, which were bigger. And then we have Steenbecks, which are bigger still. And I even have a Steenbeck 8-plate with two pictures side by side. You run the work print through there, back and forth. You look at it. Meanwhile, the work print is getting scratched. It's getting dirty. It's getting cut with literal scissors. It's getting taped together with literally a kind of scotch tape with little sprocket holes in it. It's getting projected and forward and back and this and that, and it's scratched and it looks like crap because your original negative is over in a can. You haven't messed with it. By the time you get done chopping this work print all to smithereens to the right time, you then put it through what's called a synchronizer. and side by side, the work print scene that you've edited with great effort, snip, 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 you cut and splice your original to match the work print. And even a little more complicated than that, you have two rolls of, so you have a roll of original and a roll of work print. You chop up the work print. Then you conform, you match the original to the work print physically, snip, snip, snip. Then you got that roll, except for one small problem. You can't put it through a projector. A printer. Can't put it through a printer because you would see the splices.
Right.
Because when you splice it, there's a line. You literally scrape off the emulsion, put the two together in a machine called a hot splicer, a Mayer Hancock hot splicer. You put a strip of cement on there, liquid cement with a little brush. You close a hot splicer. It cooks for about a minute. Bingo. There you go.
Wow.
Now, wait a second. But to not see the splices, you have scenes 1, 3, 5, and 7, and you have scenes 2, 4, 6, and 8 on two different rolls of film. But in between, after scene one, you have to put in a piece of black leader the same length as scene two.
Huh.
So you got your, it's called AB roll. Duh. Your A roll is scenes 1, 3, 5, 7. Your B roll is scenes 2, 4, 6, 8. And so the A roll would be scene one, then a piece of black leader the same length as scene two, which is on the B roll. Then scene three, then a black leader the same length as scene four, which is on the B roll. So finally you get your A roll done. Then you do the same thing with your B roll. When you run those two, the A roll and the B roll, through a printer, what you get is your film print, especially since you've taken those scenes and either they're butt cut or they're overlapped.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene is overlapped 12 frames or 24 frames or 48 or 96, 1 second, 2 seconds, 4 seconds, and that's your dissolve.
Hmm.
One scene is still there and it starts going away as the other scene comes over it. And that, so you're seeing two scenes at the same right. time, middle of the dissolve, and then that disappears.
Wow.
Now, having described that whole long-winded, difficult AB roll process, nobody does that anymore.
No.
Because you would do that if you were going to print from it and make film prints from it, which pretty much nobody does anymore, because what you do is you just take your scenes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You then take all of those, you put them onto video, and then you add the butt cuts in video, in a video edit on a big screen, punching all kinds of buttons, or you overlap them in video. And that's how it's done these days. So in the olden days, it was AB rolls. Then it became A rolls. And now, to a great degree, depending on your project, some people would just take their camera roll. It's more expensive, a little harder, but they would just take their camera roll, put the whole thing on video, and edit it in video.
Mm-hmm.
We never did that. We always edited in film on a machine of Moviola or Steenbeck. We always edited in film. Then we conformed the original film to match the edited work print. And the value of that is you have a vault can, and in that vault can is the film. It's scenes 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not like you have 50 400-foot rolls.
Right.
But if you ever wanted to do anything with them again, you would have to go find those scenes again.
Right. Right.
Which would be a big, so sorry if that's getting a little, a little
technical. Well, what's interesting, I mean, it's very interesting to me who makes television shows in the modern era, and I didn't necessarily start in the modern era. We certainly weren't doing linear editing like what you're talking about, but we were using crappy beta cams that cost $100,000 that you wouldn't use to prop the door up. Open today, you know, your iPhone does 1,000 times better than the stuff that we were using that you had to, I mean, we were having to mortgage our house to get that camera. And, yep. And now today, everybody is walking around with a better camera in their pocket. So it's interesting to see that. But what kind of led to that story, I think, is that we were talking about the decision to give all of the rights, and you were talking about numbers that would boggle your mind, and making films is very, very expensive. And you just illustrated very well why. I mean, the amount of work that it would take to do that is unbelievable. And it would be very, very expensive.
Physically consuming, you know, there's no question whatsoever that the cameras that we had, the tripods that we had were much heavier, much more complex. The film, you know, I mean, you got an ice chest full of film and you got to keep it cool, you know, and they figure out a way, not refrigerated cool, but, you know, you couldn't let it just go right. Making this film. But anyway, the part of the reason that I was telling that story really about the time lapse and the motion and the slow motion, we didn't really know what the heck we had filmed for maybe weeks. Right. So, and if we were in the field, maybe a month or months. And that was always a disadvantage because since you never knew what you had, you probably had to shoot too much to make sure that you got it. And so we went with called a shooting ratio. The ratio was we probably filmed 20 or 25 times more film than we needed to make sure that we had enough scenes. Part of that was to get a head and a tail on a scene. Here's a hawk sitting on a tree, you know, and you turn on your camera and you're looking at it and you're waiting for it to stretch or look around or maybe get tired of you sitting there looking at it. But the point is that, you know, you're trying to anticipate without yelling at it or clapping your hands. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. In which case, if I'm watching television and a hawk is on a tree, oh, and it flies off like that, you know, oh, they scared it off. They did that. Somebody mm-hmm. did that. Some blankety blank jerk, you know, clapped his hands or, hey, you know, whatever, to get the hawk to fly. Or an eagle or what, or the heron standing beside a river, you know, whatever it might be. If you've looked at birds enough, you can definitely see sure. whether that bird was startled, frightened, yeah. scared away, or whether it was just, oh, okay, I've had enough of this. I think I'll go someplace
right.
else.
Right.
The point I'm getting at film wise is you turn on your camera and actually some of our cameras were silent. The more expensive, the Aeroflex BL, which meant blimped. The Arri SR is an HSR. If it's not in slow motion, it's pretty darn quiet right. for wildlife to not be able to hear. Some of the older cameras that we used, Photosonics in particular, you know, you could hear it running 20, 30 yards away, and that would, you know, be a distracting factor for wildlife. And forget about the Photosonic, with which we often shot up to 500 frames a second, which is, you know, 24 frames to 500 frames. Mm-hmm. You can do that math easy enough. It slowed down 20 times. A sweet spot was about 100 frames a second, slowed down 4 times, or 300 frames a second, slowed down 12 times. Also, when you shot that slow motion, you needed more light. Mm-hmm. So you had to have a camera with a lens that would open up the f-stop more to let more light in, and it can only let in so much light. So, for example, on a cloudy day or a dark day, you could not shoot 500 frames a second. You just mm-hmm. couldn't.
Right.
You might almost barely be able to shoot 300 frames a second. And there's another thing. I know I'm bouncing around. Hopefully people find this of interest. But there's another thing, which is when you look through the camera lens, you have to focus.
Right.
And so there's an animal or a bird, and maybe it's in flight. And depending on what it is that you're trying to film it doing, you might have to follow that action. Even more than that, you might have to focus. There it goes. Here it comes. There it goes. Here it comes. In other words, there's a focal plane, and with a long lens, that's shorter and shorter and shorter. As probably most people know about photography, you know,
we're definitely following you. What was the power source?
The battery operated.
Yeah. You would take, obviously the batteries weren't as good as we have today. So what?
Well, some of them would be, some of them would be on the Arri SRs. They were more modern cameras, and the battery would be, what am I saying? The size of a hamburger, the size of a big
right,
hamburger,
right?
Yeah. The size of a chunk, not as big as a brick, but you know, definitely smaller than a pack of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Not that I smoke or whatever. But some of the cameras, like the photosonics, which were a little bit more dated and which sucked a lot more juice, we had a 30-volt battery belt. So this belt went around your waist and it had about 6 or 8 batteries on it. It probably weighed about 15 pounds. I mean, it was like putting a scuba dive weight belt, think of, around your waist. And then the cable would run up and stick in the camera. Of course, you had to have the battery and the cable and the camera all together as one package. That would be the photosonics. The Aeroflex cameras, some of the older ones were similar to that. The battery would be off board, so-called. The more modern, the battery was on board. And like I said, it was, you know, just the chunk size of a small brick, let's call it. Probably the size of one of the first cell phones that I had.
Yeah, right.
I just said the word brick, and that triggered in my mind that I had a Motorola MicroTac Light.
Yeah, I had one of those. It was about that big.
And our young daughter called it the brick.
Yeah.
My young daughter, Hannah, would call it the brick because as she got older and cameras got small, I'm sorry, I misspoke. As she got older and phones got smaller, it was obvious that some of the phones that I had still or had used that she remembered were a heck of a lot larger than the new ones coming along. And keeping in mind, at that time, even you had in your truck a CB radio.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and you'd be talking to the truckers going down. We'd traveled all over America. You'd be talking to the truckers going down the highway. Yeah, 10-4, good buddy. You know, Smokey the Bear is up ahead. Smokey the Bear, obviously, is a policeman.
Right.
You know, 10-4 is, you know, over and out or, you know, come back or, you know, all the lingo, which to tell you the truth, I kind of miss. If you miss it very much, watch the old movie with Burt Reynolds and Sally Fields.
Right.
Smokey and the Bandit
and Convoy. Remember Convoy? Who was that? That was Chris Christopherson was in that, I think.
And you know, and speaking of the old CB radios. One time I was driving from Colorado to Arkansas from a visit back home in a heck of a blizzard right there by Raton, New Mexico, between Raton and Amarillo, that flat country, you can get a heck of a blizzard. And there's a big mountain there. It's actually an old volcano. It's called Mount Capulin National Monument. And I'm driving one night and two separate individuals were stranded. One was a female, one lady, and the other was a couple ladies in their car. Well, where are you? Well, what side road? Well, what the heck? Well, you're stuck? Oh, what? I'm driving. It's 10 o'clock at night. It's a howling blizzard. They're not going to have a fun night.
Right.
Whatsoever. So I'm okay. All right. I'll go pick them up and haul them into town and drop, you know, leave their car. Their car is, you know, beyond stuck. And I always have driven trucks. International travel, all GMC, you know, Yukon XL, whatever, four-wheel drive, chains, you know, whatever it takes. Nothing has ever slowed me down weather-wise. The point is, CB radio, picked them up, delivered them, kept on my way down the highway to Arkansas. Who knows what might have happened, but had they run out of gas, had they been in their car all night long, I don't know what, I can't remember what kind of clothing they had or jackets or whatever.
Yeah.
But I remember it was a howling blankety blank blizzard.
Good thing for the CB radio.
Yep. CB radio is no place.
Hey, you know, Marty, no place. Let me ask you this. Sure. With all of the different gear that we've talked about, there was obviously big challenges with the weight of this equipment and the, you know, filming on film. I did one fishing show on film and it was really tough because they had to choose what they were going to shoot. Video guys just shoot all day. You never miss anything, right?
Right. Yep.
And then the film guys, it was a whole different world. And I realized within the first 15 minutes, I was like, oh boy, like this is a different deal. Like I've never shot on film, probably won't ever shoot on film again because it's hard to shoot a fishing show like this. I can't imagine it would be how easy or hard it would be to shoot a wildlife documentary, especially of the quality that you managed to get. But the stuff was heavy. it was different. Today we've got GoPros, we've got time-lapse things that can do that so easily. You've got a GoPro that has a battery that'll last all day. It's the size of, you know, it's a tiny little thing. What do you think was the most challenging thing that you ever filmed, whether that was a salamander or a grizzly bear? I mean, what do you think, just as you remember, what do you think was one of the most challenging things you tried to document?
All of it.
Yeah.
every last, you know, no, seriously. There was a time when my brother Mark and I were at a place called McNeil River in Alaska, and people may not know the name, but they've certainly seen the films. There is a particular river in Alaska on the Alaskan Peninsula. You know, you get on a plane at Kodiak or wherever and you fly over. You have to have a permit from the game department. They only allow a certain number of people there at any given time. It's a very limited amount of time. It's the month of August, really, but even less than that, a several week period when 30, 40, 50 bears, of course, these are big brown bears, Alaskan, which the brown bear is just a coastal grizzly. But because they have a really good diet and they have all this salmon to eat and, you know, coastal habitat, they get big. They get very big. I mean, go sometime to a museum like the Denver Museum of Nature and Science and stand beside one of these mounted bears, you know, 10 feet tall. It'll give you a good idea. But this opens the door, Tom. I'm going to tell a couple of bear stories, but I'll first answer your question. The reason that was probably the most challenging was because it was a couple of miles, I think maybe two, it might have been 3 miles from camp to the falls. Because of the bears literally everywhere, you could not leave any of your equipment there. film, lunch, tripod, anything you took, you had to carry it up in the morning, you know, crack of dawn, carry it down in the evening when you were done. And my brother Mark and I had packs that were approaching 200 pounds each. A big, you know, cameras, had more than one camera with us, tripods, rolls of film, guns, you know, one of my funny bear charge, didn't really charge stories. At the time I had a Ruger 44 Magnum. And I had it in a shoulder holster so that it was right here, you know, under my armpit. And at the same time, I had on a backpack with, you know, tripods sideways and just, you know, all kinds of all stuff. And actually, the backpack I had designed has a swing thing on it where a lens fits in, one of my favorite lenses, which is a 2.8 Canon 300 millimeter lens. Not very big, not very heavy, but we had bigger lenses than that we took along. I'll finish the weight part first, then I'll get into the gun part. So trudging along from camp to the falls and back every day, we had these hugely heavy packs, and just the simple weight of the gear and the fact that we had to bring it all with us and bring it all back every day was more challenging than a lot of times when, you got your truck on a back road. And you know, you're half a mile off a road and you're filming a moose. You go, oh, darn, you know, okay, these moose are vocalizing. It's maybe the mating season and the bulls and cows are making a noise. Darn it. So you're going to go back to the truck and get your recorder.
Right.
Maybe you jump off your camera gear and then you take your recorder and you record. To tell one more secret, a lot of people don't realize, when we filmed films, they never had sound on them. They just didn't. There are cameras and there are ways with a mag stripe down the side of the film, some old news cameras where you could film the sound at the same time that you were filming, but we never did. And so you would film the animal, open its mouth, no recording of the sound. You would have to record that later. And when we edited, you would put down a couple of soundtracks, so-called tone or background. Just the wind, shh, or underwater,
right.
Whatever it was, or the room temp. You may not believe this, but a room has a sound
right,
with
right.
nothing going on in it.
Right.
It's just it's got a sound. Then you would film the specifics, moose, you know, whatever it was, or eagle calling, or, well, you'd have a million different bird calls and you just stick something in, tweet, 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 whatever. Then, of course, you would put in the narration, word, word, word. You'd put in the music, et cetera, et cetera. The films that we did pretty much had about 8 minutes of music in a half hour program, about 8 minutes of music, about 8 minutes of talking. And then there was sound over the whole thing, but there was only about 8 minutes that was in the clear, so-called specifics. The point of the matter is that you also got a tape recorder, which was a Nagra IS, which was another 5 or 10 pounds,
right,
with the microphone and all that stuff stuffed in this pack going up and back every day. So that was the most challenging from a standpoint of weight, W-E-I-G-H-T. But from the standpoint of weight, W-A-I-T, that was another challenge. And I'll come back to that after Alaskan Bears. Sequences it took crazy amount of time to get. Once you have it in your mind, you're going to, by golly, get it. So I got my pistol. Big, for those who don't know about killing things, a 44 Magnum is about as big of a gun as you want to shoot. I mean, kaboom.
Yeah.
It's hard to hold on to it. Let's call it macho. Let's call it overkill. Let's call it Dirty Harry. You know, whatever. I mean, if you need to kill a bear, you'd be better off with a big old rifle. You'd be better off with a shotgun. You know, no, we didn't kill any of the bears. This was all personal safety, self-defense. But the point is, I'm walking along a trail. I'm trudging. Head down, I'm going back, I'm dog tired. Keep in mind, we'd had bears around us all day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, one of my scariest, silliest, stupidest bear stories, you see how I interrupt myself and then I always come back?
Yeah.
I don't know why I do that, but I do. I'm sitting at the blind. It's not a blind, it's just they call it a blind, but that's where you had to be. You're wide open, the bears can see you. And like a genius, I just ate a can of sardines. Okay. I opened it up, ate them, and set the can down beside me, behind me, you know, arm's length right there. As most of you probably know, and I happen to love sardines and they're very healthy for you in a lot of different ways, they're very pungent.
Yeah.
I have friends who don't like sardines because they don't like that fishy smell.
Right.
They just don't. Well, guess what? Bears have no problem at all with that fishy smell.
Yeah, they like
it. In fact, it turned out that bears actually love that fishy smell of sardines in a can sitting about 12 inches from my little butt right here sitting on the ground. And I'm sitting there and we're looking at the bears that we're filming or I'm messing with gear or whatever. And I smell this horrible smell. And then I feel this hot breath on the side of my face.
Whoa.
And I slowly turn, and there's a brown bear head about, bigger than a basketball. You know, I don't know, beach ball or something. I mean, you know, can't describe. Eyeball, I'm looking out of the corner of my eyeball. Eyeball, nose, about that time he snorts and slobber and boogers kind of fly on the side of my face like that.
Wow.
He reaches forward with these claws that are about as long as my fingers.
Right.
They're probably about 3-inch claws. He reaches forward and with one claw hooks the can of that, hooks the edge of that sardine can. He doesn't, I'm assuming it was a he, might've been a she. Call me sexist. I don't know. It was a big stinky thing. I'm saying it was a he. Might've been a mama bear. There were plenty of those around with their cubs and they're even more dangerous.
Yeah.
Hooks with his claw the edge of that sardine can, just very gently, very slowly pulls it back about a foot or so, and then just and starts very slowly licking it out.
Wow.
Licking the oil, you know, there was out of the sardine can, which took him a long time, probably not as long as it felt like. But the point of the matter is I'm sitting here pretty much petrified, and I know that it could have chomped me, killed me, attacked me, whatever, you know, easily by then, had that been the case. So I'm not scared, but I'm also not feeling all that comfortable. So that was the closest I've ever been to a hungry, wild grizzly brown bear.
Dang.
And to extend that story, actually to extend bear stories, I'm trudging down the path, pretty much looking down, looking at my feet, you know, leaning forward into the pack, trudging along, and look up. OMG. You know, here's a mama bear.
Oh, no.
With cubs looking at me, coming down the path the other direction. We're probably 10, 15 feet apart.
Whoa.
I stop, look up, wide-eyed. She stops. And I'm going, uh-oh. And so I'm reaching for this gun. So I'm going to grab the gun. I'm going to take the gun out. I'm going to cock it and point it at her just in case, you know, a bad situation and she wants to try to kill me. Well, I'm going to stop her from doing that. I'm reminded of, speaking of Walt Disney before, I'm reminded of a Mickey Mouse sequence. I can't remember the exact detail, except it was something about a gun tangled up or something. And I think it was a bear, and Mickey was trying to get his gun and he couldn't. And I'm trying to get my gun and it's all my straps and my backpack. And about that time I just go, okay, this is just stupid. And I felt like Mickey Mouse, and I can't do this well, but Mickey's going, oh, hey, oh, no, oh, hey, oh, pay no attention. Oh, that gun. Oh, no, hey, it's not, you know, that's nothing.
Right.
It was a stupid sequence like that, because I'm then going, oh, well, sorry, Mama Bear. No, pay no attention to this gun here. No, I wasn't going to try to pull it and point it at you. Let me just step off to the side here and you guys can go on by. I'm so sorry here to, you know, interrupt your evening stroll, whatever. Because by this time, it's probably, I don't know, 10, 11 Dang. O'clock at night.
So did she let you go or what?
I stepped probably 6 feet aside and she came by down the trail, probably 6 feet from me, you know, big old shaggy rump going by and the cubs, you know, running up behind. Keep in mind, that's not really a wilderness experience, because these bears are very accustomed to and acclimated to humans.
Yeah, but still.
Right there.
You get a mother bear with cubs.
But no, it was not a good situation.
That's not a good situation.
But I was, you know, certainly not the first person she'd ever been 6 feet from. For all I know, it was the sardine bear.
Right.
But in any case, here, maybe one more quick McNeil bear story. We camped in a tent, my brother Mark and I. And the nightly ritual would be, you would go into your tent. By this time, it's about midnight. You'd unloaded the cameras, your dog tired and whatever. It was still just about light out. There were maybe another half a dozen tents around. Then there was a little shack, kind of a cook shack that you could go into. Pretty much rained about the whole time. Most days it would rain some. Sometimes it would just rain and rain and rain. So you'd be in your tent and everything you owned, include sleeping bag, clothes, everything, was, if not soaking wet, damp.
Yeah.
Didn't really get cold, but the damp was uncomfortable. And you would crawl in and lay in bed, and then you would kill the mosquitoes on the tent. The mosquitoes, you got in the tent.
Yeah, they came with you. Up,
and then you would kill these mosquitoes that were inside the tent with you before you went to sleep.
Right.
And they were, you know, biting on you all night long. And the story that I was going to tell, the tent story that I'm going to tell. So we're in one night, we kill the mosquitoes, we're laying in bed. And then we hear this disturbance from a guy in a tent nearby. He's maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 feet away. Kind of muffled yells for help. Like, what the?
Dang.
We unzip, we look out. A big, full-grown bear had sat on the side of his tent and was sitting on his head.
Oh, man.
So he's inside the tent. The bear sat on the side of the tent, completely collapsed the tent around this guy, onto this guy, on his head. He's kicking and whatever and hitting and whatever, trying to get, well, you know, our first inclination was to laugh, which we did. And our second inclination was to not crawl out of our tent to try to shoo the bear away. You know, that was it. I think we unzipped it and threw a boot at it or something like that. And, you know, maybe she said, "Hey, get out of here, get bear, get," and something like that. And so it finally did get up and lumber off of him. He was not injured, or I wouldn't be telling the story, laughing about it. That was a pretty interesting, McNeil River moment.
Dang.
So any of you ever want to go to McNeil River, you contact the Alaskan Game Department early in the year. I mean, early, I think it's like maybe April, and you put in an application. I'm pretty sure it's still a lottery. It was back then. And you have to put in the lottery and get lucky. We were actually filming at the time for ABC, kind of American Sportsman. We were actually filming for a John Denver special called Alaska, America's Child, that John did. And we actually did several other John Denver specials after that. But this particular one was being done by John Wilcox, who's still a friend of mine, lives in Aspen these days. He at the time was in New York working with Kurt Gowdy and ABC American Sportsman. And he was the producer, coordinator, whatever, on the project when we went to Alaska, went to McNeil that one time. But anyway, the point of that whole story was that if you want to go to Alaska and go to McNeil River and you get lucky in the lottery, you can do so. You can go. I don't think it costs anything, or maybe not much, except, you know, your plane ride is going to be a pretty penny.
Yeah.
And that's what it is, McNeil River. There are other places like Brooks Lodge, Brooks River Lodge, I believe is what it's called, where we also were there and we're filming. It's fairly near the McNeil River. It's more open to the public. And times may have changed. This was a good long while ago. That you may be able to go there without a specific lottery permit. But anyway, so those are wonderful bear stories from Alaska, the heaviest equipment that we ever had to carry any great distance. And probably a normal pack is, you know, maybe 50 pounds, which is still heavy.
Yeah.
You got your camera, lunch, a couple of rolls of film. You know, you're not hauling 10 rolls of film and a tape recorder and all kinds of
that. It just seems so hard to do. I mean, we have to do similar kind of things, but man, I don't know. The equipment sure changed, and so has the barrier for entry. I mean, the barrier for entry was what one of the things that we talked about right away. You know, back then, all of this stuff was so expensive and so heavy and so cumbersome, and then you get to the edit, and my gosh, you know, your work hasn't even begun. Shooting isn't even the challenge at that point. It's like, okay, now we have these things. And then you went through that whole editing process, which seems incredibly laborious. So,
well, with film, of course,
right.
You try your best to edit in the camera,
right.
You say, okay, we got a wide scene. All right. Now we need to zoom into the, whatever subject is. Okay. Now we need some cutaways. So here's a moose grazing, but you know, you film it, you know, head to tail, but then you want to go in for the head to see it chewing or whatever, you know, and then you want to show a scene of another moose looking at this moose, you know, you the so-called cutaways,
right.
You know, because if you just have the moose chewing, well, sometimes it's okay to zoom in on it and zoom back. We literally call that zoom fever. You know, you can use it too much and it's, and of course, if you're zooming, and especially a nice slow zoom, you have to cut before the zoom starts, and then you can't cut until after the zoom ends. And so that means that that scene has to be used in a certain length. And that can be a problem when you're trying to edit a film down to a certain time.
Yeah.
So all of those things are going through your head, you know, as a camera person, when you're shooting film. As you mentioned, Tom, you know, if you're shooting video, turn it on and let her roll.
Yeah, you just shoot everything.
It's called a slam zoom or bang zoom or whatever. Different people call it different things. You know, just boom, you know, you get it in there. Boom, you get it out because you don't care.
Right.
And people probably understand this, but the important thing is, let's say the moose's head is like this and it's chewing. Well, you need to get in there, because then if its head turns, you can't make that cut.
Right. Exactly.
So anyway, it's all those things are going through your mind at the same time, you know, that you're trying to, you know, sweat and slap mosquitoes and, you know, wonder if it's time yet that you can quit for sit down and have some lunch.
Right. That's incredible. So, when was the last season that you did?
Oh my gosh. Wild America was on PBS from 1981 to 1995.
Right. And then specials like the John Denver specials?
Oh, positively. So then after that, you know, into the 90s and the 2000s, we did the 1 hour specials in conjunction with King World.
Yeah.
And one other thing I'll say, and this is kind of amazing, if there's anyone out there who would like to invest in some wildlife films, boy, oh boy, have I got a deal for you. I literally have, and I'm not bragging, I'm just telling you, this is the business, this is the way the world works. I have 20 new half-hour Wild America films that I have more than $1 million invested in, that I have been unable to find the money to complete.
Mm.
So basically, these are talking about the film, the work print and all that. These were shot in film. They were edited in film. And by our long-term film editor, conformer, down in Boulder, and now he's up in Broomfield, Carl Hunsacker. And I love to give these shout outs to these people, give them credit. Carl conformed all the Wild America programs. Maybe he didn't do a few of them. I can't remember the details, but he pretty much did them all, which is cutting the work print, cutting the original to match the cut work print.
Yeah.
So the work print's been edited with a kind of Scotch tape. The negative thing gets conformed to match that, and it gets spliced together with a hot splicer and cement. And those, we've edited the work print, we've edited the original. We still need to put on, as I explained, the sound effects, the music, and the narration. And boy, oh boy, some of these programs are terrific.
Hmm. So how much would it cost to finish them?
They were produced at a cost of about $50,000 each. It would probably cost about $25,000 each. 25 times 20 is you know, probably $500,000.
Yeah,
which is less than anything these days. I mean, it's less than a 1 hour, you know, of any pretty much, you know, primetime television, the program that's on.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. There are individuals, and I'm not going to talk them down, but there are individuals who these days shoot in video. And they shoot documentary style, and maybe it's someone or a couple of people fishing or hunting, and they're walking around with their shotguns and whatever. And they shoot them, you know, they film them, video them, not film. I say film, but they mm-hmm. shoot them in video in maybe a day or a few days or maybe a week at the most. And those are probably more like, I don't know what, 20,000, 10,000. Mm-hmm. I don't think 5,000 each to produce.
Right.
Substantially less than shooting in film.
Right.
Substantially less than a shooting schedule, which took many months. One of the programs is about gyr falcons. It's incredible. One of the programs is about good grief. My mind is spinning. The Roadrunner coyote is amazing.
Yeah.
There's one about grebes. I know it's a weird bird.
No, I know that bird. Yeah.
If you've ever seen some of the old Walt Disney films, there's two of them running side by side on the water.
Right.
Running across the water, the Western grebe and several other kinds of grebes. The title of that is Graceful as a Grebe. And not having not been put together. Good grief. One of them is When Animals Attack. A guy gets attacked by a deer, a white-tailed deer, whatever. But anyway, 20 half hours. So if you're out there, if you want to invest in some wildlife films, give me a call. Marty Stauffer, Aspen, Colorado. I've received, probably look it up, Google. It's MS or Marty at wildamerica.com.
Yeah.
MS at wildamerica.com, Marty at wildamerica.com. But I've literally received down through the years, I've received letters to Marty Stauffer, Aspen, Colorado, and I've received letters to Marty Stauffer, Colorado.
So people got it there.
Kudos to the post office.
Yeah.
for figuring that one out.
Like, but I know where this one needs to go. Yeah, So as far as like you have the unfinished project there, are you working on anything else?
You know, in a word, kind of, sort of. One of the things we're working on, and this is another website, wildamericaventures.com. One of the things that we're working on is licensing the Wild America brand. Sounds easy, and that's a project that we're working on. Another one that we're working on, like I said, is the, you know, these 20 new, I called it Incredible Animals. Mm-hmm. It's really 20 more Wild America episodes. But the way you license it, if you license them separate, that might need a different title. It's just 20 more Wild America episodes.
Yeah.
You know, they're not hosted by me. They could be easily enough. Stand up with a camera. Hello, everybody. Here right. I am. But it's the, you know, it's the subject, you know, the subject. One of them popping into my mind is Jaguar Jungle.
Wow.
So that one was shot down by a Mexico, down in Mexico, some jaguar.
That's cool.
Yeah, well, they're great. They're great films. But like I said, well, I didn't say, but I will say, I shouldn't say this, but this is one of my isms, and I've said it enough that I probably, you know, could be quoted any number of times. You know, I have, like I said, some isms, and one of my isms is the world went from four channels to 400, from film to video, and from quality to crap.
Well,
sorry for people out there making wonderful videos. I'm sure there's a lot of them, but you know, that being the, call it, I don't know. It's not racist. It's not sexist. I guess it's filmist.
Yeah.
That's a rude filmist comment against video.
Well, it's a different world, man. It really is. And you know, I don't have that much experience with it except for shooting that one show on film, and it was an awakening. I mean, I was like, wow, that is really hard what those guys are doing.
And shooting is hard enough, Tom. Yeah. You know, the shooting is hard enough, as you noted. You know, then you get to the editing and you get to the finishing. You got to edit in the sound effects because they don't exist.
Right. It just seems so difficult.
And in our case, whatever, we had the budget that we would hire, you know, composers, mm-hmm. some terrific, terrific composers, Patty Carlson, John Murtaugh, Neil Argo. Neil, recently deceased, actually, bless his heart. He did the Wild America theme song. And John Murtaugh, he did some stuff. Maybe I shouldn't say this out loud, but he would go to London, England and record After Hours with the London Philharmonic. And that would enable us to afford things that were not affordable. Union musicians, and we used some union musicians. We certainly did. And filmed a lot in the United States with union musicians. But in the case of certain instances where it was about a huge orchestra of 30 or 40 individuals, it was not in our budget.
Yeah.
It all that way. So,
well, what an incredible career that you had. That's it's amazing, really. And certainly, like you said, they used to put those things on after school. I used to come home and watch them after school all the time. And
hey, you're dating me.
You're dating me too.
Like, I was just a little tyke, Marty, when you were an old man already.
Well, I know.
It's funny you should say that, Tom, because that was one thing that, here, one of my isms, and I'm not always criticizing, joking, teasing other people. One of my isms is, well, I'm older and I'm fatter and I'm grayer, but I'm much wiser.
Yeah, there is definitely that. And that
I've made every mistake in the book. You know, and in fact, I'm just bouncing around. But that's one of the other things that I say. I say, when we finish filming, we're ready to start.
Yeah.
The point being, let's say you go to Arkansas and it's a month of April and you want to film wild turkey and you want to film them doing their whole strut and their whole gobble, their whole, you know, Thanksgiving spread and fan and, you know, mating with a hen. And then here's just the eggs hatching and the cute little babies and whatever. Sounds real easy. You say, yeah, let's go film wild turkeys. They're cool. No problem. You then find out where you can film them and when you can film them and how you can film them and when not. Yeah. Any of that stuff works. And it's so funny because you'll talk to so many people and they say, oh no, man, you should have been here last, you know, April, or
it's the same with fishing, man.
You need to come back in August.
Yeah.
This would be fabulous. Just come back in November. Right.
That sounds very familiar to our fishing show. You show up someplace and they're like, oh, you wanted to do what? Oh yeah. That was last month.
That's right.
Okay. Well, what can we do this month?
Last month, next month, or forget about it, son. You're not going to film that.
Lefty Cray, the famous fisherman, he was funny. He had lots of isms too. And he would always say, the fishing was so good, I thought it was yesterday. That's what he said all the time. But man, I really am thankful for you coming on the show and sharing a lot about your career. And it's really interesting. And man, you just produce so much good stuff. Can anybody watch it anywhere?
Sorry?
Can you watch your stuff anywhere?
Oh, I should tell that story. I should tell that information. Yes. But it's on all over the place. I mean, it's on television, and I'm not even sure. I can't tell you what it is, you know, the time or the channel in a certain place. It's on like 145 television channels all over America. Look for it. It's on the internet. For example, Amazon Prime. If you have an Amazon Prime membership, you can watch the Wild America programs there. You can pay a little bit if you don't have that membership, or you can watch them for free if you do. It's being put up now by an individual. I'm doing business now with a film distributor, Art Skolpinski of Monarch Films back in New York.
Okay.
And he's getting them put up on some other places. I believe I'm correct in saying Xumo, X-U-M-O.
Okay.
And a couple of others, Pluto.
Okay.
Is another one. You know, just look for them. And yes, they're on the internet, or they're going to be on the internet. Sling TV, I believe, is another one that he's working on.
All right.
Getting them up on. That being the future we actually sold a whole bunch of VHS video. I'm not selling them anymore with King World. Mm-hmm. And then Marty Stauffer Productions in Aspen, Colorado, we then sold a great quantity, thank you everybody, of DVD sets. But I do know you can go on the internet, in particular eBay, and you can find Wild America video sets for sale, or the individual videos. Actually, they have them VHS for sale. Some people still have those machines. I still got a couple of them. Or DVD, on the internet, also on eBay. You can buy those, the sets or the programs. Put out different ways. Topics Entertainment up in the Northwest, up in Seattle area, they did some that were different kind of a packaging from the ones that I did in DVD. Mm-hmm. So yeah, have a look online, eBay in particular. It's timeless content and, you know, top quality, and, you know, enjoy, because it's kind of a little negative for me to say, but there are some groups, the BBC still does some great stuff. that have some good programming out there. But by and large, it's not the glory days of wildlife filmmaking anymore. For the obvious reasons we talked about. I mean, yeah. I hate to be so crass and monetary, but, you know, what do they say? It's all about the Benjamins,
right?
You know, it's all about the money. You have to have a large enough audience for the advertisers to sell enough commercials to pay for enough of a budget to go do these programs. And so it comes around, and there's more than 400 channels out there, obviously. Sure.
4,000, 40,000.
Four channels to 400. Well, forget about channels on the internet, you know, which are easier to search, at least Wild America.
Yeah.
You know, you can find something to watch. But yeah, the world has expanded, probably fair to say, for better and for worse, better or for worse, I guess. But still, yes, the Wild America content is whatever. I'm assuming it'll be, well, it is still around, and but long after I stop making any programs, even if I make these 20 new ones one of these days. But let's just call it high quality programming about American wildlife. Unless I'm mistaken, it's really not getting made on an extensive basis. There's one here and one there. There's young people doing this and that. Different ways. I mean, there's a series on Smithsonian, and it's flying over America, and it's a different state or a different, you know, subject or whatever, a different geographic locale.
Right.
Pretty amazing, because the whole thing is aerial.
Right.
Well, and we would put in a few aerial scenes, you know, of flying over an eagle's nest or flying over, you know, a beautiful area. But we never, none of our programs really were all completely aerials.
Right.
But so in other words, there are different ways to present the same thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So
that's, well, a lot of things change and a lot of things stay the same, but, quality always rises to the top. Well, Marty, I think that's probably a good place to end it. I really appreciate you coming on. And, if anybody has anything you want to get in touch with him, you got you put your email out there already, but right. Give it one more time.
My initials, Marty Stauffer, ms@wildamerica.com, or even easier, Marty, M-A-R-T-Y at Wild America, M-A-R-T-Y at W-I-L-D-A-M-E-R-I-C-A.
All right. Right on. Okay. Thanks, Marty. Thanks, I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
Thanks for allowing me to reminisce the good old days. It's still good, but just, you know, some particular funny moments. So thank you so much.
Yes, sir. We'll do it again. All right. Thank you. See you.
Thank you.